With the Park City School District now fully immersed in teaching two foreign languages, Spanish and French, in our elementary schools, the district will now be adding a third language, a written language that is understood worldwide, coding. In the studio with details is the CEO and founder of Emerald Data Solutions, Ari Ioannidis, as well as the technology coordinator for the Avondale, Arizona Elementary School District, Grant Smith. Good morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Good morning.
So, Ari, you're spearheading the idea then to bring this coding technology to Park City School District. How come?
Yeah, well, actually, it was an idea I had back in January. I was part of a kind of pilot program with the City of Atlanta schools in an inner city school that I went to called Grady High School, where basically the high school students back in the 70s taught each other programming because no one knew it. So you couldn't find a teacher who knew how to code. So basically they gave us a terminal hooked up to an IBM mainframe and a book on APL and said, teach each other. So the seniors taught four of the freshmen. And then by the time I graduated, we had a program where we were teaching about 20 students how to code. And all the people who went to that class, whether they went into technology or not, have all become successful. And remember, this is an inner city school, including the students who are from the projects. And honestly, I wouldn't be here with Board Docs if it wasn't for that. And so it's time to turn that around and roll it out nationally. So when I talked to Abby at the Ed Foundation about, hey, how would you go about rolling something like this out nationally to develop a elementary school coding program, she gave me some great ideas and then talked to Ember, Dr. Connolly, who basically turned around and shot me an email very quickly, said, hey, we want to do it here. So I had no desire to have rich white kids learn how to code. This, to me, is a thing to help underprivileged students because it's really the fastest way to get successful. But Park City stepped up, Dr. Connolly's commitment with Dr. Eichenhorn to take a curriculum and build it and pilot it here before we roll it out nationally was the goal. It was their idea to do it here, not mine.
So are you behind it in terms of you being Emerald Data? I mean, it's something that your company's doing, or?
Yes. We've been always very engaged through the Ed Foundation and on a national level through education. We actually contribute more bottom line revenue to nonprofits in education than we do for our own profit. So obviously that's where our money comes from. That's where we want to give back. To us, investing $500,000 over the next few years to develop this program is just a kind of a no-brainer. And honestly, it's easy. You'll hear from Grant. This is something that when I talk about it at the national level, people go, how do you do it? It's not that hard.
So what's going to happen? I mean, we have the curriculum.
Well, technically, and I'll let Grant, it's more a curriculum guide. No, it's 200 pages. So it's actually pretty good. But it's not really a curriculum. And so Dr. Eichenhorn here is, I was impressed with her from day one. And she's really working with Dr. Connolly for the new vision for the curriculum here at the school district that is much more integrated. So, and I'll let Grant talk about what he's doing, and then I can tell you what I know about what I think is going to happen here. But to have her on board writing this curriculum based on the guide that Grant and his team have come up with is just wonderful. I can't believe it. So all we're doing is talking about it nationally through our contacts at the National School Board Association and about 15 or 16 of the state school board associations, and then promoting it and putting the money behind it to make it happen. And then, of course, we'll give it away.
So, Grant, your district then is already running this?
Right. So we just finished our first year, our pilot year of teaching all of our students from kindergarten all the way through eighth grade computer programming every day. We replaced our technology special area class where they normally just type or do PowerPoints and modernized it to teach them coding. And we used resources that were out there already. Like Ari was saying, this is not a difficult thing to do. We didn't spend any extra money on it, but we're kind of cowboys out there. We're doing our own thing, and that's why we wrote this curriculum guide to help stay true to ourselves. But having a national curriculum for everybody to follow would be amazing. And we're real excited to see what comes out of Park City.
Yeah, well, we heard Ari's kind of success story, knowing coding. Why do you think it's something important that we teach our children?
So we teach all of our kids to code because it fulfills our district mission, which is to develop thinkers, problem solvers, and communicators. It's just an added bonus for us that this could bring our kids out of poverty. 86% of our students get free and reduced lunch, and 77% of our students are minorities. So that's just an added bonus. Why we really teach it is when you have to break a problem down and then construct a solution for it, you have to know how to think logically and you have to know the problem-solving process. So nowadays with Google, we don't need to memorize facts like we used to. Everything is out there on the internet. What we need to do is be able to analyze information and make solutions that nobody has come up with before. So solutions that we can't Google. We have self-driving cars. We have holograms. We have jobs and technology that are coming out of nowhere that we can't keep up with. But if we teach our kids code, that underlying language of all this new technology, then they'll be useful in the workforce.
Yeah. Since it's just a pilot program, you got a year under your belt. I mean, you can't really talk about success at this point, or can you? I mean,
well, we think we can. The thing is, coding in school has been around, like Ari was saying, for a while, and I'm not sure why it hasn't become part of the core curriculum yet. We have, our board has adopted it as the official curriculum for our previously called technology special area class. So now it's officially part of our students' core curriculum, and all students every year will receive this curriculum. But we've seen some amazing projects come out of our students' classes. In fact, I hate to say this, I do think highly of my students, but at one point I had to check the internet for the source code from a project because I thought a student must have cheated. But they didn't. It was completely their own project. It was just so amazing that, you know, I had to second guess them.
Certainly our kindergartens are native to computer technology at this point. But really, what can a kindergarten learn about coding?
Right. And that's what we have the view on, or we have the view that learning to code is just like learning another language. And a lot of our students are bilingual. So we think that teaching them this separate language, the language of code, is actually better to learn at a younger age so that they can build on it as they grow.
Yeah, so that's what we often hear about a foreign language, right?
Right.
The earlier you learn, the more you retain.
Well, exactly. I want to pick on what Grant said. And when I talk about it in these terms, people are shocked. If I told you there was a school district somewhere or an education system that neglected to teach the pervasive language that existed in that culture, in that environment, what would you say about that? And you would say that's a travesty, right? And it's shocking. You can't go a minute without touching some sort of technology and interacting with code. And the fact that we're graduating students who can't read it and write it, but they maybe can read and write music, which is just as easy to do, or maybe read and write a second language, is horrible. I mean, as a coder, I can just about pick up any piece of code and read through it. Right. And to think that, you know, like when we talk about coding, you say an hour of code. What if we said an hour of English? What if we said an hour of any of the other subjects that are just as important? We need to be teaching this language. It's a competitive advantage. The president's talking about it. Coders who just know how basic to code JavaScript can make $150,000 a year without a college education. Our lead programmer makes close to $250,000 a year, doesn't have a high school diploma.
Wow. So let's get to the nuts and bolts. So a Board Docs or Data Emerald solution is paying for this? I mean, and hiring the teachers? And
we're working through the Ed Foundation here to fully fund this program. So we're not asking for any additional money. Once it's piloted here, we will run a program through an inner city school to prove that it can be done really at any level in a different way. And then we will give it away. We're also going to work with some Sundance film makers to make a documentary about the process so that we can, because nothing tells a story like a movie. And Grant's having a hard time getting the word out, and he's got success. That's one thing, you know, Board Docs does real well is getting the word out. So we're going to, like, I'm going down to Savannah to talk to the Council of Urban Schools, in a couple of weeks about this very thing.
Yeah. But again, I mean, certainly you can give away the curriculum, but you've got to have the people in place to teach it.
It doesn't. Grant will tell you. This is how much did it cost you guys to put this together?
So $0. So what we did is just retrain our teachers. A good teacher is a good teacher no matter where you put them. If they're teaching English, in fact, our teachers consist of a former PE teacher, a classroom teacher for second grade, a music teacher. They come from all over. It doesn't matter. What I look for when I'm looking for our new coding teachers is, can you teach in the classroom? That's all I want. And we actually use the grandmother strategy, which is we ask the teachers to act like their grandmother would if they don't know what the answer would be to a student's question. So you would say, oh, I don't know what the answer is. Could you go figure that out? You know? And so in that way, the teacher's no longer the expert in the room, but we're fostering a different type of learning, and that's more project-based learning, where the students are working on their own and with their peers to figure it out, kind of like Ari did back in the day, right?
Right.
And that's a great model because this isn't something where the teacher has to be the one in front of the classroom and just teach it. In fact, our model is student-paced. So a kindergarten student and a fourth grade student could theoretically be working on the same project, depending on how fast they go. And this, you know, you've heard of Move On When Ready, right? This is the literal version of Move On When Ready. Students only move on to the next unit or project when they're ready to move on. So the teacher is more of a facilitator instead of a sage on the stage, as we call it.
And really, we're teaching the ABCs of the language and the mm-hmm. basic language, right?
Right.
So we're not especially the first two levels, anybody can do it.
Right.
You know, you could teach, Leslie, you know, somebody the ABCs. So and what the sounds are like, and probably teach them how to read. Anyone can do that. You don't have to be a novelist to teach somebody how to read.
Right.
So these teachers don't have to be coders. You know, we don't need Zuckerberg in here teaching them, you know.
But it would be nice if in the future, because right now you could major in education for music or education for history. It would be amazing if in a couple years we can get education for computer science and get some pre-service training for our teachers so that they will know the latest strategies and the research-based ways of teaching this.
And the huge thing is the state legislatures have not designed standards.
Right.
We don't have any testing. This is easy to do right now. Mm-hmm. We don't have to write to any particular rules. It's like, what are we doing? We're teaching them how to code. Mm-hmm. What's the end result? To pass this test? No. To learn how to code. To develop procedural competency. So it's honestly the easiest thing we're going to do. We're mm-hmm. really excited about it.
And so that's the great thing is that we can do what we want because there's no testing. But at the same time, there's no teacher preparation because
right.
it's not
it's
a national thing yet.
Right.
So when we get to that point, then it will be nice. So.
Right. One more thing to prepare for. So, all right, tell me, again, the specifics. You're looking just to bring it to one school or to all of our elementary grades?
That'll be up to Dr. Conley. I was honestly impressed that with as engaged as the parents are here and all the ideas that are floated, that in the middle of doing teacher contracts, redoing the master plan, redoing the curriculum, introducing a new reading curriculum, all that's going on, she took the time to come to me and say, I want to do this. So my guess would be that they would identify one school to do this in early, but you'll have to check with her, and that eventually it will be rolled out district-wide.
Okay. So it's going forward.
That's my understanding, right? As a matter of fact, we're leaving here this morning, and we're going down to the district office to have a meeting with them so that they can start working. They've been working on it for a while. They've got a really good committee on it. So I would think this fall you would see coding in the classroom, in some classroom here, and it would be all students.
Okay. I need to leave it at that. We've been talking with the CEO and founder of Emerald Data Solutions, Ari Ioannidis, and the technology coordinator for the Avondale, Arizona Elementary School District, Grant Smith. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
Given that this interview was pre-recorded yesterday afternoon, as of last night at the launching of the program, it was announced that the program will be introduced to first graders in all four of Park City School District's elementary schools this fall. The following year, it will be rolled out to the all-day kindergartners, as well as first and second grades. Ioannidis told a group of educators and Park City Education Foundation supporters that we're going to change the world with this. Well, as we reported, Park City Acting Planning Director Kayla Sintz has announced her resignation, and former Planning Commissioner Bruce Erickson will be brought on board until a new Community Development Director can be hired. In the studio with details on that, as well as a preview of the Park City Council agenda for tomorrow's meeting, I have Mayor Jack Thomas and Assistant City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So, Jack, Kayla's decision came about pretty quickly, I'm guessing. She didn't know she was moving 2 months ago when she accepted the interim job?
Well, I don't know. 2 months ago, that's shortly after that, I think we realized that she was getting married, and she had this opportunity, and this business opportunity came about quickly. And, you know, it's a personal choice. And so it was one, I think, that they suffered over because she likes working with the city. She's worked on two previous occasions with the city and very committed, incredibly talented person. So, you know, I'm sorry to see her go. And I like her. She's been a friend. She's actually worked in my office for some time as well. So it's a loss. But I think it's clearly a personal choice and an opportunity that came about.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and it's got to kind of throw a wrench in the wheel here. No, I mean, what does it mean for people who may have an application in the works? I mean, do you anticipate a big slowdown as everybody else gets geared up?
Oh, I don't think so. I think, you know, each planner in the planning department takes projects on. You know, Kayla administers over the rest of the planners, so I don't think anything's going to be a problem. And just the idea of bringing Bruce in, who obviously has incredible skill set and experience with regard to planning matters, will streamline that process.
Yeah. So how did you get Bruce Erickson to agree to come on board?
Some serious arm twisting, coercion. No, Bruce is from a family that has exceptional commitment to this community. And, you know, he's taken a break here for a while. As you know, he's been on the Planning Commission for I think, 16 years, which is amazing. He was my mentor on the Planning Commission, and I always thought he was, well-informed and understood the code and really understood the nature of the community.
Now, does he want the job full-time, or was that part of the deal?
I think he was interested in 4 days a week. And that allowed him to do some of his outside consulting. And
so he is not necessarily applying for the community development position.
Well, not at this point. You know, anything can happen in the future. But, you know, we're just fortunate to have somebody with that institutional knowledge and background to step up.
So where are we in hiring a new community development director?
We have recruited Prothman Services. Prothman's a nationally recognized headhunter. I believe that they were the firm that actually helped bring in Tom Fisher, the county manager. And so we've engaged their services, and they're going to run a national recruitment for us.
Okay, so that really hasn't even started at this point?
Well, we are in the early stages of that, and the commitment that we have from that firm is that we could probably, or we will likely have an individual in that position in September, October of this year. Gauging their assessment of the economy and the workforce, they think that's a fair estimate for us.
All right. And then how is this community development director from West Valley City helping? Sounds like she's already got a full-time job.
She's a professional that's worked in the state for 17 years, working with RDAs in economic development and community development. She also works at the legislature, and so she's a very, very well-known individual to several of us in the city, but also has a great reputation across the state. And I think that we were looking ahead and anticipating that, you know, if you work in this town long enough, there's bound to be a few applications that you can't address or can't review as the planning director. And so we saw an opportunity here to just bring in sort of a 1-2 punch with Bruce and Nicole, who's the community development director in West Valley City. But the benefit of West Valley City is that they have a 4-day work week. So we're going to bring her up here on Fridays on a consulting contract. We think that's just a nice balance and sort of the 1-2 punch.
All right, and you're specifically tasking her with the Lower Park Avenue redevelopment area, which you got a planning charrette scheduled for next week.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay.
And Kayla's on board here for a while, too, while we do this transition. So it's not as if there's going to be an empty office up there for some period of time.
Yeah, when does she actually leave?
She's probably the second week in August is when she's actually going to leave. And I should note that, you know, the rest of the team up there has done a terrific job. And we'll continue to support them in any way that we can. I've worked with that team personally for the last year, different developers and property owners and contractors, and have gotten to know a lot of people in this community. So I'm going to continue to support that team there.
And you know, everyone else in City Hall will as well. The legal team that supports that team on a day to day, and it really does take a team. And I think we're making sure we've got the right people in place in an interim capacity. But I don't think you'll see any disruption in services or anything like
that.
All
right, let's move on to the agenda real quick here. In the manager's report, the city talks about getting defibrillators as part of its emergency plan. The report says that we already have 26 of these in 8 buildings and 10 police vehicles. Now looking to add 3 more to trailheads and parks. Where exactly?
We're going to add one at the trailhead at the barn, the McPullen barn trailhead. And then, to be honest, the two other locations escape me now. But this was a concept that we actually brought home from City Tour. When our group was in Vail last year, we noticed that they had these defibrillators in public areas where often people were recreating, and they had several instances where they had an incident or an accident that actually happened in the outdoors outside of one of their facilities. And so we thought this was another nice layer of protection that we could add to our community, the people that come here to visit, and residents. And so this is something that you're going to probably see grow over time as we add this amenity.
Yeah, so any concern, though, that people might be using this that don't know what they're doing? Because these are those machines where you have to make sure that people don't have any metal on them, you know, make sure that people stand back, as you say, clear before you, you know, shock somebody. It's
right, and so they do come with instructions. They are ADA accessible, so it's an audible command system. But we service them regularly. We need to make sure that the equipment is up to date and serviceable. And it's something that, you know, it obviously does take some ownership and responsibility in our community. When we spoke with Vail, our first question was, don't they get vandalized? Do people tinker with them and play with them? And their response was resoundingly, you know, no, people respect that these are there to provide a public good, that necessity in the case of an emergency, and they have been just very, very pleased with people's respect of that type of equipment and its sensitivity. And so, you know, knowing who we are as a community, we anticipate sort of the same.
All right. I think this was a part of the Shark Tank, wasn't it, consideration? And it didn't win, but we're going to fund it anyway?
Right. It didn't win. I think it came in a close second or a close third. And Hugh Daniels, our public safety manager, just made a great case for trying to do this within existing resources. And this was important to council. This is one of those items that when we were doing the Shark Tank, they said, hey, we've got to keep an eye on this one. There seems to be a clear need, and we would love to see this expanded. And then so staff put their heads down, got to work, and found out a way to achieve it.
Okay. Also, a Main Street parking update. And the report says that since China Bridge was built, the second phase here, we've lost 22 parking spaces between building KPCW and the liquor store, the City Hall Plaza, the bump outs. And I guess we could add a few more to that because we've got 2 taken up by the rental cars and 2 that most people can't use with the electric vehicles. So, I mean, what else is it that about this update? I know that you've got a parking management study underway to tell us what.
Well, city staff, Blake Fonsbeck and Brian Anderson, Public Works and Parking, are responding to a request from City Council to give them a high-level overview of the parking inventory in Main Street. And so I think, if I recall, you know, there was about 250 spaces or 220 spaces added with the addition in China Bridge. And then subsequently over time, due to public safety improvements and other matters, there's been a loss of a few spots here and there. And so they were trying to create an assessment for City Council to give them an accurate depiction or an accurate picture. Now, to dovetail with that, that staff is also engaged, as you mentioned, in a parking management plan for the Old Town area. And that's going to be a comprehensive assessment of the parking inventory and the measures that we're taking as a staff in terms of enforcement and parking space turnover. And so it's going to be a very holistic approach. It's from a nationally acclaimed transportation firm, and that's due by the end of the year.
All right. Is it not going to be done in time then to implement some kind of parking plan? Because I think this was being done, right, to manage the employee parking?
Well, it will, and that's a great question. And it's going to include all aspects of Old Town. So it's, we're trying to take a thoughtful approach in balancing the economic and commercial needs of the commercial district here in Old Town. also taking into account the impact of the employees that are working here, as well as the residents. I mean, there's a residential component to this. There are residential parking requirements and parking permits. And so this is going to take a look at all of those together in a holistic way, and not just not just consider one alternative. It's going to consider all these factors.
All right. Council also scheduled to talk about purchasing 12 new buses. I mean, have you decided whether these are going to be diesel, the hybrid, or the CNG buses?
We have. At this point, we've got at least 12 buses that have reached their utility and their life cycle and need to be replaced. And so in December, our staff put out an RFP. We had several responses, and really one, the most qualified response to restore our existing fleet was for diesel buses from the corporation, the Gillig Corporation.
Well, we've already heard from one person who lives along the bus route saying it's awful to have to smell diesel buses every 20 minutes.
I think that staff has heard that complaint, and in this RFP we included elements for CNG and electric vehicles. But at this point, given our needs and given the expediency with which we need to replace these 12 buses, we felt that to meet the existing levels of services and the demands for a transportation system, the most reliable option at this point was the diesel buses. Now, that doesn't preclude us from making changes in the future. And the contract that we're requesting council's approval for is a contract with options. So, you know, we absolutely will make this first purchase. It's a necessity for our existing system to maintain the existing levels of service, but that doesn't preclude us from being proactive down the line and seeking alternative measures and methodologies.
So federal government pays for up to 80% of this. They would only fund diesel buses?
I'm very fortunate. I don't think it's necessarily that they will only fund. I think it is difficult at this point, given those kind of newer technologies, to get the same level of reimbursement. But we're very, very fortunate to have that. And I think I probably should have led with thanking our partner there. You know, the fact that we get that reimbursement is one of the things that allows us to have this system and the size of the system and scope that we have. So we're very fortunate for that reimbursement.
All right. And then finally, with regard to a housing amendment, basically it just says how, you know, a certain amount of square footage, commercial square footage is built, and then affordable housing units have to be constructed. So are the changes being proposed here, or are they going to be more costly to developers, or is it just trying to clarify what we're already trying to do?
Well, there's two changes. One is an update of our fee in lieu when the code triggers an affordable housing obligation. So the fee in lieu is an element that a developer, you know, negotiating with the city could choose to pay. It's updated annually, and that's prescribed by code. So staff is making that annual assessment of the fee in lieu and making a recommendation to increase the fee in lieu.
And so what
the
is that?
The fee in lieu is an assessment of economic factors. It's a five-year average of home sales. And so it's going from roughly $139,000 to $143,000. So that's the first change.
Per unit.
Per unit. That's correct. And then the second change is we had an individual, a developer in town who has a development coming online, is very familiar with our code, and knows that the scale and size of his development will trigger an affordable housing obligation. And one way that he thought would be unique to address that would be to build it early and just take care of what he expects his affordable housing obligation to be. And so that is not currently allowed in our code. And staff knows that one of City Council's top two objectives at this point is affordable housing is one of them, and diversifying our housing stock. And so city staff felt it was an appropriate policy discussion, and we needed some feedback from the policymakers about whether allowing a developer to fulfill affordable housing obligation prior to the development is something that we want to consider. So the change that staff's recommending it doesn't go ahead and approve that. It just allows the housing authority, or vis-a-vis city council, to appropriately make that decision. And our code does not allow that now. And so we wanted to make sure that, you know, there may be an instance where city council says, yes, we want more housing and we want it now, and this is a nice way to add to our housing stock. Or they may say, you know what, we're not in favor of that location of where you're wishing to put it. And so at this point, we're not going to approve that request. But currently the existing code didn't allow allow for that. And we thought, you know, we should check with the policymakers and see if they wanted to make that change.
Sounds like a no-brainer. I need to leave it at that. Jack and Matt, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
8:47 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Well, coming up this Friday night, an opportunity to see a couple of dance performances right there at the Kimball Window on Heber Avenue. In the studio to tell us more about that, I've got Nathan Webster and Charlotte Boy Christensen with Now ID. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So what's going to happen?
So we're doing two performances, one that starts in the windows at the Kimball Arts Center, and then it moves into the main space. So we're actually adding four dancers into the space just for a small performance of 7 to 8 minutes.
Okay.
At 7 o'clock.
I need you much closer to that mic there.
The times for the performances are at 7 o'clock and 8:30.
Yeah. And it's the same performance, but you get to see it from many different angles, which I think is always interesting.
Okay, so will the people watching watch it from the window, from outside, and then move into the, or
the
do
thing
they
is,
just stay outside?
No, they can move in, and I actually recommend that they do. So maybe start watching it from the outside and then gradually move into the space so that you really get a chance to see, especially the performance that then takes place inside of the space, because at this point, because of the exhibition that's taking place there now, there is a separation in the space. So I think it's important for people to know that they should really sort of venture into the space after sort of viewing it initially from the outside.
And we think there's going to be a lot of people there, and that's one of the reasons we're doing it twice, so that people can see it from a couple of different angles as well.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me about what's Now ID.
So we're a contemporary interdisciplinary dance company that also does site-specific productions. So doing a production here at the Kimball Arts Center kind of very much is aligned with the philosophy of what we do. We have so far done about four major productions at various sites all over Salt Lake City at the Masonic Temple, the Great Saltaire. Actually, next week we're doing our next one at the Libby Gardner Concert Hall, also in Salt Lake City. So we've really sort of specialized in creating works that are very much set in a specific site and then having that site kind of become a collaborator in the process.
All right. And so this, what's on going on in the main gallery that you're working with?
We're doing, what we're trying to do with regards to this production at the Kimball Arts Center is taking two excerpts from a production that we're doing next week at the Libby Gardner Hall and sort of trying to transplant them into a very different space and seeing what that does to the piece. But also, I think in terms of people coming in, watching the exhibition to see how the dance perhaps adds some layer of understanding or flavor or nuance to the exhibition.
And the exhibition at the Kimball right now is called You Are Here. Our piece the following week on the 17th is called Nowhere.
Or Now Here.
Yeah, or Now Here. So both ourselves, Now ID, and Kimball found ourselves dealing with a similar concept of place. And we our artists that we have involved, it actually kind of blends quite easily and perfectly with the exhibit that is happening at the Kimball right now. There's an artist from
Iceland.
Yeah. And Charlotte is from Copenhagen, so we have a little bit of a kind of a
Scandinavian
flair. And we're looking and working with the artists that are involved at what it means to be of a place or not of a place, and the kind of longing for something, and what is it that makes one feel settled versus wanting to be somewhere else, perhaps.
And I want to add to that, like, we are actually one of the pieces that we're going to be doing at the Kimball Arts Center has a new composition by Icelandic composer Steingrimur Rólov, who's doing compositions for our productions next week at Libby Gardner Hall. So we thought it would be fantastic to actually sort of almost premiere this new composition, this Icelandic composition, in this exhibition that also features Icelandic artists.
So are you going to have speakers outside so people can hear the music?
Yeah, I am trying to work that one out tonight. So we'll see.
Probably be more inside the sound. And I think the idea with the window is it provides an opportunity to see it from two sides and draw interest so that people can come in and see what's going on there.
Yeah, I think that's kind of mentioned earlier with regards to the site-specific nature of the company. We're continuously trying to find new ways to actually engage audiences and actually have audiences view dance or view performances from various angles that are perhaps less traditional.
Mm-hmm. And, so yeah. You're a Utah troupe?
Yeah, we're actually based in Salt Lake City. I I'm originally from Copenhagen, as Nathan mentioned. He's from Vancouver, so we have kind of an international angle to the company. We bring in a number of artists from outside and then really have them merge with local artists and kind of create a dialogue in terms of what's happening in the arts, not just locally, but globally.
Yeah, and different media as well. We're primarily, well, at least Charlotte is a choreographer. We've got one of the principals from Ballet West, Catherine Lawrence, is involved
she's
in this.
In the performance. She's going to be in the Kimball Arts Center performance.
And the other dancers have a contemporary background, but a blend. Charlotte's work is a bit of a mix, but I, as an architect, we also try to look at spaces to see what the space can, how it can influence the concept or the movement of the dance or the audience through the space. But also for our bigger ones, we can combine set design and video and installation and live music. That's why we're doing it at the concert hall. The same piece that's being performed or played here at the Kimball on stereo equipment is going to be played live
on the organ
in the concert hall at Libby Gardner on the big pipe organ. It's quite something.
It's going to sound very different. That's also why we kind of encourage people not only to come and see this performance here at the Kimball Arts Center, but then really kind of think it's like an amuse-bouche for the performance next week at Libby Gardner Hall, where they will really get a chance to see some of this performed live in a different venue, but also, as Nathan mentioned, with live music.
So you'll have how many dancers then?
Four. Yeah.
And again, the performances you're saying lasting like 8 minutes?
Yeah, so each one, and it's actually going to be the same performance. I keep saying as if there are two different performances. They are going to be different in terms of where people watch it from, so they're going to see different things. But it is the same performance. It is repeated twice. So if you feel as if you didn't see it from the right angle, come back at 8:30 and see it again.
Okay, again, that's happening at the Kimball Arts Center this Friday, 7 and 8:30 p.m. Great. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is the KPCW Local News Hour in the studio now with our monthly youth sports report from Team Park City United Executive Director Ryan Walsh. Good morning, Brian.
Thank you, Leslie. It's great to be here.
So what have you guys got going on?
Well, I'm not the Executive Director of Youth Sports Alliance. I am the Executive Director of Team Park City United.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm here to represent the YSA today. And just a quick update, I'll go through them at lightning speed to be efficient. The Winter Welcome, a hot reminder, October 24th, the 35th year of the JANS Winter Welcome, the most visible event for YSA, supporting the 9 competitive teams who sent 18 athletes to compete in Sochi last year. Tickets are about $250. There's a silent and live auction, and the Winter Welcome opportunity drawing is a bucket list trip to the French Open. And athletes and folks in each of the organizations are offering those opportunity drawing tickets for a requested donation of $50. The Circle of Excellence is coming up in mid-September, where we honor sort of the best, brightest, and most inspiring athletes that we have in our organizations. And we'll also have someone being inducted into the Hall of Fame. We'll have former Hall of Fame inductees Josh Christensen, Ted Ligety, and Chris Hatch Haslock among the folks who've been inducted so far. So we'll be putting someone else new in the Hall of Fame. The Golf Scramble was a couple of weeks ago, and that was very well attended, successful, and fun over at the Canyon's new golf course. And the parade, of course, super fun. A lot of folks participated. We, as Team Park City United, had our own float right behind YSA, and so we got to watch all of them and have our own group right with them. Figure skating is in competition right now. They were out at the Broadmoor Open, a prestigious event for their schedule. Bryn Roberts was just off the podium in her pre-juvenile free skate and won the spin event. Rennie Doyle set a PR in her intermediate short program, and several members are heading up to Sun Valley for the later in the month for a big competition. Meanwhile, over at in our shop, we are out at the UOP jumping and flying out into the pool. We've got skate and inline programs going on at the skate park here. We're doing mountain bike stuff in the summer, more of an activity than a program. And we've just introduced wakeboarding and wake surfing as a program. And I'm really trying to get some folks to show some interest and register for this program, because we kind of need a minimum to make it worth splashing the boat. We have some girls' camps coming up in July 11 and 12, then the 25th and 26th, and August 8th. And we're doing a fun event, Leslie. We're calling it Moms Away. where moms of our athletes can come out and try the ramps at UOP. We just had an event that we called Fathers Fly Free, and it was a great success. Had about 20 or 30 participants, and we're hoping that Moms Away is similar. So moms of Park City, come on out to the UOP and jump in the pool with us.
When's that going to happen?
That's August 15th.
Okay. How are those new jumps working out for you guys?
They're great. There's a little bit of break-in, right, because they're new, and we're finding out things like sight lines and safety, and the signage is all being updated. And I just had a really neat meeting yesterday with the safety group over there and some of our coaches, and they're still ironing out some of the kinks and some kinks that they're discovering. But the good news is everybody's being flexible, and we're doing great stuff, and the jumps themselves are performing really well.
Great. All right. People can get more information about the wake surfing, wakeboarding, and the girls' camps all on
your
website?
Sure. So, yeah, the teamparkcityunited.com will have information about our club. You can find out more about the Youth Sports Alliance and Jan's Winter Welcome and upcoming events at ysaparkcity.org.
Okay. Ryan, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks so much.
It's Ryan Walsh with Team Park City United.